Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to this week's edition of Talk Nation Radio, Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is a co-founder of Roots Action at rootsaction.org. He is the founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His books include War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He writes the Political Culture 2013 column, and he is my friend and my colleague at rootsaction.org. Norman Solomon, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, David. Pleasure.
It's great to have you on here. I want to talk about rootsaction.org. I want to hype that amazing organization. But first, I think we cannot forego talking about an amazing debate that you recently had with Colin Powell's former chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, on the Democracy Now! Program. What was this debate? How did it come to be? And what is the disagreement between you and someone that everybody now sort of thinks of as a progressive activist, Lawrence Wilkerson?
Well, part of the impetus for it was the 10th anniversary of Colin Powell's now infamous speech to the UN Security Council. You know, the one where he had the test tube and the blown up grainy photos and the intentionally badly translated phone intercepts and so forth, all purporting to show that there was, without a doubt, a lot of weapons of mass destruction in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And so realizing that this important anniversary was coming up, which was early February, the original event in 2003, I thought about how given how the mass media are in this country, it's very unlikely they're going to give much attention to the 10th anniversary of what is arguably the most important, destructive, mendacious speech by a U.S. diplomat in the last half century. So, you know, why pay attention to that, right? Especially when so much of the mass media, if they did any sort of coverage of the anniversary, would be in such an awkward position because not just Fox News, but the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so forth praised the speech as a brilliant masterstroke of genius and truthfulness when it took place. So I wrote a column on that subject in early February this year and ended up on Democracy Now!, somewhat to my surprise, with the other guest being Colin Powell's chief of staff during the time he was Secretary of State, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. And I was asked by a producer beforehand, you know, do you think this will be a debate? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. We will agree on some things and not others. But it did turn out to be quite a debate.
It did indeed. And there seems to be a pattern among officials who see the light of day or are affected by a change for the better in the culture, that they will talk about how they did their best and they resisted internally and they didn't resign, they didn't speak out, they didn't denounce or seek to press charges, but somehow they quietly resisted what they were a part of. What is your analysis of what Larry Wilkerson did and what he should have done as chief of staff for the man who presented that package of lies to the United Nations?
Well, his storyline for himself and I think for his friend Colin Powell is very much that they meant well. You worked with the information they had. In retrospect, like quote-unquote everybody, at least in government, they believed there were WMDs in Iraq, and that's as far as it goes, and where they won't go, and so to speak for them, a bridge too far, is that they should have resigned while the war preparations were underway in real time, that they should not have just been good soldiers, so to speak, and continue to keep whatever doubts they may have had quiet and basically function as accessories for the war machinery. And that came up really during the debate when I raised the reality that Dick Cheney didn't make them do it, that Powell and Wilkerson and others could have resigned, could have spoken out and used the First Amendment when it could have really made a difference before the invasion of Iraq. his immediate response was, you know, I don't really want to get into an on-screen debate with someone who doesn't understand what it's like to be in government, hasn't been in government in a day in his life. So, you know, there you go, David, so much for the concept of the consent of the governed. And frankly, the whole debate, to me, had two threads to it. One was a sort of clash of different perspectives and, at best, a sort of dialectical discourse. And the other was down the rabbit hole of Alice in Wonderland. And in the latter category was the time when he got into talking about how I should have called him, and that it was somehow he was implying very strongly my fault that I hadn't gotten hold of him and Secretary of State Powell so I could have sat down and talked with them. The outcome of that I couldn't quite fathom, except that they could have said that they talked to an anti-war activist, but given that their bosses, Powell and Wilkerson's bosses, by Wilkerson's own account, were hell-bent on going to war, and given that Wilkerson, by his own account, had no intention of doing anything publicly to either challenge or disassociate himself from that drive for war, it was really a bizarre sort of a comeback. And as I mulled it over, I think maybe he was just desperate to say something that had a semblance of sense to it.
Do you think that he really is operating and was operating in good faith and was inside a bubble and couldn't imagine alternatives? Because if you go back to 2005 or so, when Congressman John Conyers was in the Judiciary Committee in the House, as he still is, and was opposing wars and investigating war lies, the reports that he produced included countless instances of facts that were in that speech that the State Department's own experts had warned were unreliable, undocumented, would not be deemed credible by his audience at the United Nations. There was dialogue that Colin Powell claimed to quote in his presentation, dialogue overheard among Iraqis, that was fabricated. When you look at the details of what was included and what was excluded from that speech, it looks like very, very intentional, conscious deception. I mean, you have Saddam Hussein's son-in-law having told the British and the United States about all these weapons that used to exist and that they had all been destroyed. And Colin Powell cites his reference to their existence and omits the fact that he said they had been destroyed. I mean, how could all of this happen in good faith?
Yes, I think you make some key points. It was in Newsweek, for gosh sakes, before the invasion. John Barry did a one-page story that Hussein Kamel, the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, had debriefed and told his interrogators after he defected that there were no WMDs. And as you say, at the UN, Powell simply cherry-picked, left that out for some reason. Memo that was dated a couple of days before his UN speech directly to Powell from government investigators that the aluminum tubes argument he went ahead and used in his speech was bogus. There was nothing particularly fine about the tolerance used in putting together those aluminum tubes of the weaponry that were being talked about. And I think this goes to the underlying bubble concept. I don't doubt that people in all reaches of government, and certainly at the top, live in bubbles. And in a sense, arguably, everybody tends to. We have certain spheres that we are acquainted with and not. And these folks are isolated and okay. They don't get a lot of information that gets through their particular routines from outside of it. But that said, I think it's preposterous in this situation, as in so many, to use this sort of bubble argument as an excuse or an exculpatory explanation. If you listen to, for instance, the Lyndon Johnson tapes, they really explode the notion that Lyndon Johnson was in a bubble. He knew the war was going to be a disaster. He had all this trepidation. He knew it wasn't going well. And that's laid out in excruciating detail when you listen to the President Lyndon Johnson tapes. If you read Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, he really talks about how he felt for so long as an official at Rand Corporation, at the Pentagon, and so forth, in upper reaches of the Pentagon, he felt as his sort of professional, profound, patriotic duty, it was to provide good information to the president. If only the president, Kennedy or Johnson or Nixon, would get the information that was accurate, then they would make much better decisions. And Ellsberg's book really lays out the evolution of his understanding that that's not what it's about. And as a matter of fact, I remembered after the debate with Wilkerson, a book written by the great SDS activist Carl Oglesby back in the late 1960s. I remember reading it, I think, in 1967 as a teenager, when he was addressing this assumption among many liberals and people on the left at that time that people like Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara and President Johnson, they just didn't understand what they were doing. They didn't realize the impacts they were having and the manifestations of U.S. policy and what it would do. And what Carl Oglesby put out in that book, Containment Change, is his theory, which I think turned out to be very correct, that these government leaders, in fact, knew what they were doing. It was not a mistaken policy from their vantage point. They had these priorities, which in that case was to really destroy the country of Vietnam as well as a lot of Laos and Cambodia, and to kill huge numbers of people in the process.
Yeah, it seems to me that they asked the State Department about the aluminum tubes, and the experts said those are not nuclear. They asked the Energy Department. They got the same answer. They asked the military. They got the same answer. They had to come down here to Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live, to the Army's Ground Intelligence Center to hire a contractor who would say what they wanted said for the right price, who got promotions and bonuses out of it. And they took that lie, and they took it to the United Nations. It looks intentional. The other question I have about the stance of Lawrence Wilkerson and company that they didn't know because nobody told them, it seems to me that many of the nations of the world refused to go along, didn't believe the so-called intelligence, that the world saw the biggest single day of mass popular demonstration in world history, and that in fact the United Nations ended up rejecting the argument, as Colin Powell and his staff must have known was a possibility when they were presenting it. Is it really credible that they didn't know there was another side to the argument?
Well, it was all over certainly the independent media. I was on Democracy Now! In this debate, and I said, well, it was on Democracy Now! It was in the news releases that we at the Institute for Public Accuracy put out. We put out dozens of news releases in real time with people like Hans von Sponeck and Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspectors. That stuff was out there if the people in power wanted to pay any attention. Not only did they not want to pay attention, they slandered and cast aspersions on the honesty, integrity, and patriotism of people who raised these issues. And I think that the reality of the protest around the world that you allude to was seen as a threat to these policymakers. One of the most infuriating memes that we got, and we got it again in this debate in early February of this year with Colonel Wilkerson, is that it wasn't just U.S. government intelligence. He said, you know, the Israelis and the British and all these other intelligence services told us the same thing. And it turns out, in fact, that so much of the so-called information and analysis coming from foreign intelligence services was actually a rehash and a repackaging of what the CIA and the U.S. government was feeding to them. And, of course, some of those governments, certainly the Israeli and British governments, had their own agendas to want to foment a war. So the net effect was the UN was treated as just another propaganda staging area, and of course, something that I talked about in my column and in my book, War Made Easy, very much in evidence with that episode with Powell at the UN 10 years ago, when he said that the United Nations would be risking irrelevance if it didn't approve an invasion and go along with what Washington wanted. And here we are in 2013, and the attitude is very similar, and I think I wanted to get to that, both in terms of the UN and in terms of just following orders in Washington. In terms of the UN, it's still an attitude that the United Nations is doing relevant work when it does what the guy in the Oval Office wants it to do. And the issue of just following orders is still with us today. You know, we have more troops in Afghanistan today than we did when Obama took office. There are, I have no doubt, a lot of people in medium and upper reaches of the Obama administration who have doubts about the cruise missile and drone assassination, so-called targeted killing program, and they are silent, and they are refusing to speak out, speak up, quit in protest, And I think that in 10 years, some of them will be talking in just the way that Colonel Wilkerson is talking now. And the point is, it doesn't do much good later on to say your misgivings. History happens in real time, and that's when you got to take action.
Of course, a handful have spoken up and been charged with espionage and been threatened with decades in prison, so there can be a risk. But a lot of activists outside of government as well have fallen silent, and you haven't. With a new gang in the White House and in the Congress, you've co-founded a new organization, Norman Solomon, called RootsAction.org. Which I'm proud to say I am also doing work for. Tell us the origin and the goal of creating this new online movement.
Well, the roots, so to speak, Roots Action go in, I think, a perception that so much growth has happened, and certainly this radio program is part of it, that has accentuated and improved vastly the capacity of people who want a different sort of world based on humane values rather than profit and violence to reach out with information, analysis, perspectives, mutual support. And so radio shows, some TV done independently, online websites, publications, films, plays, music. We've really had a creative, in a positive way, explosion of these means of distributing all sorts of creative efforts and information and analysis. But our capacity to build muscle in the sense of action that's coordinated is lagging far behind. And so RootsAction.org was founded and is doing work every day now to try to add an action component so that progressive movements don't just have a good way of informing each other of what's going on, but actually galvanizing action. And that's why I encourage everybody listening to our discussion here to take a minute and go to RootsAction.org, type in your email address and your zip code, and you'll be part of this growing effort that now has more than 200,000 people as active participants in RootsAction.org.
There, of course, were online groups prior to the creation of RootsAction.org a little over 2 years ago. There was a huge one known as MoveOn.org and several others. Is there an analysis you had that something was lacking, that a new organization was needed for a particular reason?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much of a commonality that people have. They want to do something, they care deeply, and there is I would give an analogy here. People in earlier generations might relate to this as well. There was, in the 50s and 60s, there was Perry Como and Mel Torme, and then rock and roll came along, and it's all music. But just because something is in place, it doesn't mean that it is serving the function of people in the present time. And I do feel that way about Move On and some of the other fairly large, of which Move On is the largest, online action groups. I like some of what Move On does, and especially at the grassroots, there are literally millions of people who are signed up who are doing a good work. But Move On refuses to challenge Democrats in power when their policies are reprehensible. And I think the acid test is if you imagine now what's going on out of the Obama administration, and you take off the word Obama, and you take away the label Democrat, what would we say about those policies if it was a Republican in the White House doing those things? And the reality is, I think for so many people, but not for the leadership of National Move On, we would find those policies repugnant, and we would oppose them. We're in a crisis now where so many people are pushed and pulled into conformity to be silent or to mute their voices, and to refuse to challenge the assault on civil liberties, the constant warfare, the alignment with Wall Street, the failure to challenge the fossil fuel industry with climate change at stake, and so much more. And that's a challenge and also an opportunity for us to get more real, to get down to the political and human realities. It means we're independent, and it means we're willing to back what we believe in.
The goal of creating an organization of people who are for peace and justice and a sustainable economy, regardless of the party of the president or the Congress, the majority in Congress, seems a tricky one. Are you losing people who might agree with you on some matters because of your willingness to criticize Democrats? Are you organizing people who are already of this independent frame of mind, or do you think Roots Action is helping to move people actually in that direction who weren't quite there before?
Well, some analysts will use terms like not always so, or in motion, or one dramatist I read talked about how if you look up in the air and you see an arrow, for a split second, it looks like the arrow is stationary, but it's always moving. That's the reality. And that's true of political environment and politics and movements as well. And so I believe that, yes, there is some resistance in a negative sense to having a single standard of human rights and a single standard of political ideals. And some people will be put off. But the word you used, independent, is so important because in the long run, whether it was the civil rights movement or anti-war movements of decades earlier or today, independence is really crucial. And so when I say to people, hey, please go to rootsaction.org and sign up. It'll take 1 minute, and now we're going to be 200,001 and 200,002. It's part of a growth process that's really essential.
It seems that there are a lot of organizations with a progressive agenda, at least on domestic issues, on economic issues, that are taking a stand against cutting Medicare or Social Security. Or if President Obama is for cutting Medicare, then they take a stand against cutting Social Security and vice versa. But it seems that Roots Action is adding a different component in that it's not just for taxing the wealthy and protecting human needs, it's also for defunding military spending. Can you talk about how that is a different approach from some other organizations?
Yeah, RootsAction.org combines independence with being multi-issue, and we don't blink or nod or wink at certain issues because we feel they're going to be divisive. We don't go out of our way to be divisive, but we don't, so to speak, stay away from a nonviolent fight that has to be pushed, and certainly on the question of cuts, we're very much in that realm of trying to focus on what kind of cuts. And thanks to you, we have at rootsaction.org on the homepage a video that directly addresses the question, are we for or against cuts? And answers quite graphically and effectively, I think, with the common sense, but too rare observation, that depends on what kind of cuts we're talking about. And in the current era with another cycle of crisis or pseudo-crisis on Capitol Hill, that's very much the question. Are we going to cut the military? Are we going to cut Social Security or Medicare? What kind of programs are going to be sliced up, and which ones are going to be left intact? So it all comes down to the specific.
I know that an organization that's only 2 years old, and only, if that's the appropriate word, 200,000 members strong, has not yet completely reworked priorities of government spending or cleaned the money out of the corruption of our system. But it seems that Roots Action has organized some coalitions, won some victories. One that comes to mind was halting a rather offensive television program called Stars Earn Stripes. Could you talk about that campaign or others where there have actually been achievements already?
Yeah, I think the coalition building really goes hand in hand with a consistent standard and a willingness to just speak clearly, not rhetorically, but also not evasively. And so Stars Earn Stripes was something that was heavily promoted by NBC leading up and through the Olympics, and they wanted to sort of come out of their Olympic jag with picking up viewers. And so we had these stars and others going and pretending they were going to war, and it was presented with the hosting of former General Wesley Clark as some sort of fun extravaganza, which is so pernicious and certainly part of the war for state culture. And I'm really proud that Roots Action took the initiative, built a coalition, and then created a petition and presentation of the petition with tens of thousands of signers. And I think we were really a factor in just the disrepute publicly, including from Nobel Peace Prize winners, that this NBC terrible show gained. So none of that is preordained, then I think, as in so many other realms, you know, if we tune into politics and just say, wow, what a bummer, or just confine ourselves to denunciation, which is part of what's needed, then we end up being passive viewers of these horrific trends, whereas we can jump in and change history, not just consume it like some kind of white bread.
In the minute that we have left, I'm assuming that you would agree with me that beyond online activism, we need some activism in the real world. How can the online organizations facilitate that, work in harmony with that, bring about the sort of nonviolent creative movement offline that many of us think is desperately needed?
The synergy is so important. I mean, just the use of online technology to help people learn how to communicate with people who live near them, whether use of zip codes or whatever. And it's certainly part of our hope with Roots Action that we do go to action in the streets and in communities and so forth. And rather than virtual online connectedness being the center, it's a facilitating aspect of what ultimately we need, which is change the basic daily operations and sensibilities of our communities, because that's where the social change has to happen.
We've been speaking with Norman Solomon, who is a co-founder of RootsAction.org, along with Jeff Cohen, another co-founder. And as I say at the end of this show every week, go to RootsAction.org and take effective action. Norman, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Hey, thanks, David.
After recording this interview with Norman Solomon, I blogged about his debate with Lawrence Wilkerson and Colin Powell's testimony. And Lawrence Wilkerson replied to my blog stating in part, quote, "Your use of INR's assessment of weak repeatedly is weak itself." Here he's referring to the State Department's own intelligence operation, which, as I say, had warned Colin Powell repeatedly that his claims would not even be plausible. Lawrence Wilkerson continues, INR was at the time one of 15 intelligence agencies in the U.S. intelligence architecture at the federal level. Add Israel, France, the U.K., Jordan, Germany, et al., and of course you get even more. INR's assessments were often viewed, indeed still are, as maverick within that group, and were particularly so viewed by George Tenet and his deputy John McLaughlin. Wilkerson goes on to claim, whether Powell had given his presentation or not, the president would have gone to war with Iraq. Now, Wilkerson is wrong to list those nations, as Norman Solomon has already explained, as having provided independent intelligence in support of the U.S. position. He's also wrong to dismiss Colin Powell's own staff at the INR, which told him that numerous claims he was going to make and did make would be weak and questionable and even implausible. Powell used fabricated dialogue. He used evidence from a source who had admitted all the weapons had been destroyed years ago, but failed to mention that bit. Lawrence Wilkerson himself, in the MSNBC documentary Hubris, states that claims he'd rejected were put back into Powell's speech. That is a moment to resign in protest, not to move forward and dismiss the INR, the State Department's own experts, as, quote, maverick. When the Pentagon and the White House build a transparently fraudulent case for war, rejected by countless experts, many nations, and much of the public, the State Department's job is to support fact-based analysis, regardless of whether it is maverick. Lawrence Wilkerson accused Norman Solomon and all other truth-tellers of that time of having failed to warn him, as if we weren't shouting into every available microphone. If word had slipped through, it seems that Wilkerson would have rejected it as maverick. This is discouraging. If analysis within our government consciously engages in groupthink, where will we find the whistleblowers necessary to prevent the next war? That Bush might have gone ahead with the war anyway had Wilkerson and Powell resisted is absolutely no excuse for their cooperation. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.